You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome to We Are STS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. It's the very first episode. You're in for a treat today because we've been waiting a long time to get this podcast started. Off we go. Well, each year, we send a list of readings to our new students as a bit of summer work. That list aims to sample across STS as a subject. There's a bit of history and philosophy of science, there's a bit of sociology, and there's a bit of science and technology policy. We want to get that creative energy flowing for everyone while they're waiting to get started at university. For our episode today, I've asked one of our third year students to interview one of our tutors about one of the books they chose and to simply ask why. Niza Mia is doing the interviewing. She has a summer studentship working with me on this podcast, and this interview is one of the projects she made during her summer work. Niza interviewed Dr. Jack Stilgo about a book published in 2014 in the area of technology policy. The book is Evgeny Morozov's To Save Everything, Click Here: Technology, Solutionism, and the Urge to Fix Problems That Don't Exist. It's published by Penguin. We pick up their conversation from the start. They're speaking over an internet connection. So here's Niza.
Hello and welcome to the UCL STS podcast. I'm Nizhar. I'm an incoming third year undergraduate on the History and Philosophy of Science course. Bit of a mouthful there. And I'm joined by Jack today. Hi, Jack. If you'd like to just introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jack Stilgo. I'm an associate professor in science and technology studies at University College London. And at STS, I teach courses on policy. So the science policy course, and in particular, a third year module on, I call it governing emerging technologies, but it's basically about how new technologies fit into or clash with society.
Brilliant. So yeah, I'm actually going to be taking that module, hopefully, if I'm in third year this year.
That's excellent. I would be disappointed if you didn't, Nizhar.
Yes, I really, truly enjoy science policy. But when I arrived to UCL, when I started the undergraduate course, I didn't have a great understanding of policy. So the goal of our podcast today is give undergraduates a bit more of an understanding of what exactly science policy is. So, Jack, you recommended Evgeny's To Save Everything, Click Here. And that was a book you recommended on the reading list for science policy. I just wanted to know, why did you pick that book in particular, considering how much, obviously, there's so many different books to pick from. Why that one in particular?
So Evgeny Morozov, let me just introduce him. So he's not an academic. He's a sort of freelance author, but reads a lot of STS ideas and writes about STS ideas. And for students that are coming into the discipline, I thought this would be a really good introduction, partly because he doesn't write for an academic audience. So he's writing to communicate STS ideas to the outside world, which means, and I'm going to insult my fellow academics here, he's a much better writer than most STS academics. And so the stories that he tells are really engaging ones. The way that he communicates the ideas, I think, work really well. So my hope was that if you could, if students could read some or all of this book coming to STS, they would have some sort of grounding in why we think about the things that we think about. And it gives, I think, a nice platform to then do the deeper academic reading. So the book, Evgeny Morozov himself is a guy that for a few years and over a few books has been developing a critique, a social critique of what has come to be called tech, right? Tech in inverted commas, which is not just a set of new technologies, right? Tech is in some ways a new power base within our society. So, you know, of the 10 most valuable companies now, I think about 8 of them would define themselves as digital technology companies. Companies that barely existed 20 years ago, if at all, like Google, Facebook, Amazon, are now the world's largest companies. They are the masters of the universe. So when we think about technology in society, we shouldn't just think about the gadgets. We shouldn't just think about the apps and the widgets. We should also think about what it means to have, you know, these people developing technology in positions of enormous power in our society. And so that's what Evgeny Morozov is taking aim at through all of his writing, actually. More recently, and we can talk more specifically about this book, but more recently, one of the interesting things that he's done is develop a project that he calls just the syllabus, where he and a bunch of other researchers, writers, look at what is being published relevant to technology and society, and they produce these reading lists, which is great because, you know, one of the things that we do as academics is produce reading lists. But they have a very wide-ranging set of materials. So every month they bring out these syllabuses, which are great. So I'd encourage everybody as well to look up just the syllabus and Evgeny Morozov's name to find what he's doing there.
You know, that's super interesting, especially because you mentioned that Evgeny isn't actually an SDS academic himself. He doesn't, I think I researched, he works more in politics in general. And I think that for as a student coming in, just shows how easily you can apply different disciplines to this aspect of technology, if that makes sense. Yeah. Tech kind of feels reserved for other disciplines. So synthesizing philosophy and technology was something for me personally, I didn't kind of consider. And to see that all disciplines are acknowledging that and having a great critique, because like you said, this technology and its political power that it exists now wasn't a thing 20 years ago. But again, for me, I feel I'm a Generation Z. So for me, I've always kind of been hyper aware of that. I've been very aware of like how powerful technology is because of the way it's been affecting me today and the way it has controlled political decisions I've made and the political decisions I've seen.
That's interesting. And it's something that I've really noticed as I've been teaching my emerging technologies course, is how, you know, each year progressively the students are more engaged with and more aware of the questions around technology. Mm-hmm. Because I think they realize that, well, not only is technology and are the developers of technology having more and more influence over the way that we live our lives, but that technology is not just, you know, a good thing, that it comes with downsides. And those are downsides that people, I think, are much more aware of than they were. But as you say, Nusa, I mean, these are questions that in most cases are either deliberately or accidentally sort of sealed off from public debate. The idea is, oh, well, you can't talk about technology unless you are yourself a technologist, or leave that to the experts. And one of the things that Evgeny Morozov and more broadly within STS, one of the things that those thinkers do is they say, no, this is the stuff of democratic politics. Mm-hmm. And if we don't question this democratically, then decisions will be made about our lives that are hugely consequential, and that we're not having a say in them. So the philosopher Langdon Winner that students will be reading at some point during their degrees has this phrase that we sort of sleepwalk into technological change. Mm, right? We end up surrounded by technologies and we wonder, well, how did we get here? And why did nobody ask the questions?
Yeah, I understand what you mean. And I also think it's kind of, again, I feel as though me growing up, technology has always been an extension of my being. But I genuinely feel like my phone, the internet have all been extensions of my, like, the way I think, the way I do things. And I've never seen the world any other way. And you're right, in sleepwalking into society that's making decisions of how we use technology when they're such, obviously we all know they're important to us, but I don't think, again, I think I literally, when I say I literally feel as though they're extensions of our being, the way our family is, the way we are like members of society, we're all interconnected in that sense. To think that we don't have the voices, or that we don't have a way for us to actually be have meaningful contribution to these debates, it's kind of both scary and both, again, it's very new. We can't, I feel as though it's not a way to point fingers and blame. I think as consumers of technology, it's like, it's necessary for us to speak up about it as well. Yeah. And I think S empowers you to do that, that just because I'm not a technology, like, I'm not that, I don't know, like, the makeup of the hardware of a computer, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't mean I can't have a contribution or a meaningful commentary on how we do it. Does that make sense?
A great way to put it. Yeah. So, I mean, but maybe it would help if I just said a bit about this specific book, because if the general project is one of the critique of technology, and that's, so critique in quite a, you know, in the sense that we talk about the literature criticism, right? This is not criticism to say this stuff is bad. We don't criticize literature to say literature is bad, right? We criticize it so that our culture can make decisions about what to consume, what to read, what it means, you know, how it relates to its context. And Evgeny Morozov and a few others, like, you know, Nicholas Carr is another writer who see themselves as tech critics, you know, enabling us to make good decisions. And the way that Evgeny Morozov tries to do that in this book is to, well, he popularizes this term solutionism. He says, the way to analyze technology is to ask about the relationship between problems and solutions. So he says, you know, the tendency is to start with technology rather than to start with questions of social needs and start with questions of politics. And we tend to privilege technology and assume that, you know, technology in some way is going to solve problems that we have failed to solve as democratic societies. But he says, well, what problems does technology solve? What problems does technology ignore? And in imagining technological solutions, how does that change the nature of the problem? So there's this famous phrase that to a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? That we reimagine the world to suit the solutions that we have to hand. And Morozov would say, yeah, that happens all the time with technology. So a technology is created or developed, and then the problem is imagined in order to fit that. And maybe later we can talk about some of the examples that he mentions. Mm-hmm. But this is crucially political, because some problems get selected for attention and other problems don't. So, you know, it matters who is developing technology. It matters that a lot of technology, new technologies, are coming from places like Silicon Valley, and they are being developed by rich white male communities, you know, to caricature the developers of technology, which means that some problems get highlighted and other problems get overlooked. So, you know, solutions might be offered to people that already have a lot of stuff, but they have lots of disposable income, and therefore selling them more tech becomes quite easy. So we see a lot of the development of business projects that, you know, are designed to improve efficiency, but we don't see many efforts to tackle, you know, problems of inequality, problems of healthcare, problems of poverty. And where those problems are, or where technologies are justified in terms of those problems would not be recognized in the same way by the people that are experiencing. So if we look at this question of problems and solutions, following Morozov's analysis, we can get a really good handle on the on the politics of technology, which isn't, you know, that's not a new point that Morozov's making, but it's one that he brings up to date, especially with respect to digital technology.
Hi, everybody. Professor Joe Kane here. Let me interrupt. Let's just take a short break. Well, let's get back to our interview with Dr. Jack Stilgo by our student, Nisa Mia. They're talking about technology policy and a book we asked incoming students to read, Evgeny Morozov's To Save Everything, Click Here, Technology, Solutionism, and the Urge to Fix Problems That Don't Exist. Back to Nisa.
I think we've always seen how closely technology and politics has worked throughout history, but to see the actual question, to actually question the political philosophy and how technology fits into this, into at least traditional Western political philosophies, I think was interesting, in the sense that I think he was talking, I think in like at literally at the beginning, he was speaking about how there needs to be opportunity to make error, to sin, and to actually make mistakes in technology, which I think is really interesting, because in general politics, like there's this kind of approach that we can't make mistakes, but with technology being so novel, I think, what do you take on that room for error, room for to just make mistakes and allow that to happen? Like how dangerous, how, and not to scaremonger, but how, what do you kind of take on that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. So, you know, if you, the particular philosophy of technology that appears to be coming from Silicon Valley, recognizing that, you know, Silicon Valley wants to sell its stuff, is one in which the aim is quite often one of efficiency. So the sorts of things that, you know, to a moral philosopher might make us human, which include things like, you know, sinning, forgetting, being uncertain, to a technology developer might be seen as problems to be solved. Morozov talks about, for example, technologies that help us remember. A technology, you know, in the sort of caricature of the technology developer would be that forgetting is a problem to be solved. And therefore, if there's a way that we can come up with a technological appendage, a sort of prosthetic to compensate for human failings, then we could do that. And Morozov's question would be, well, you know, is forgetting a problem? Does everybody realize it's a problem? Would everybody agree with the diagnosis of that problem? And if somebody tries to solve that problem, what might the unintended consequences might be, and what might that mean for society? I mean, for anybody that wants to ask that particular question, there's a beautiful film called The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind that had Kate Winslet and Jim Carrey in it, where they talk about, you know, it's a sort of sci-fi speculation on a solution to forgetting. And they talk about the misery that causes as people are unable to forget past traumas and past relationships and move on with their lives. So, you know, you can take issue with the problems that are being imagined around technology.
It kind of reminds me of that. I don't know if you're familiar, but with the Black Mirror episode where they have technology that records and everything they see and everything they hear. So they have that technology, and it's kind of the episode revolves around like a couple struggling with faithfulness.
Absolutely. I mean, Black Mirror is amazing source material. So amazing source material for the course, but also for the sort of critique that Morozov is pointing towards. And a few of the episodes actually get at this thing where, you know, the instinctive approach of Silicon Valley developers is to say, well, surely more data is better than less data, right? More information is better than uncertainty or ignorance. And yeah, there's a few episodes of Black Mirror where they say, well, what might that mean for surveillance, for privacy? The other book and film that I would recommend is The Circle, which, you know, parodies this Google-like company whose obsession with more data means that, you know, it rides roughshod over any considerations of privacy, because the idea is, you know, the assumption is, well, surely people want to know more, and therefore that is a good thing for individuals and a good thing for society.
I think, yeah, especially since society has become so information rich, I think there's two things to take away: is who decides that something is a problem rather than just a business opportunity. I think those are two things that clearly are quite a moral slippery slope. What is a problem and what is just simply another way not to just make money. I do believe there's some sort of like intellectual creativity going on that they want to explore. But it also makes me think about, in general, not to be terrified of these prospects. Like, I know Black Mirror, it's kind of marketed as like, oh, not scaremongering, but like, in a sense of, oh, we should get rid of these technologies. I don't think that's what we're trying to present is to, and I think is an integral part of STS as well, is that we're not saying these technologies are innately evil and trying to ruin society. It's more of like, we need to take a step back and question, like morally question from different angles in a less emotionally loaded and kind of neutral perspective. That like all these things have pros that we've clearly thought about. But I don't ever like to think that technology is innately evil and trying to destroy society, and it's just a bunch of rich scientists like trying to make business opportunities and kind of exploit us. I don't think that's the narrative I want to build.
Yeah, I'd agree with that position. I think, you know, and that position sort of it fits with the idea of, with the need for informed debate about technologies at an early stage, so that we can make those sorts of decisions, so that we can say, well, what does good technology look like, and how might we encourage more of that, and what sort of questions would we like to introduce to that debate? You know, one of the things I talk about a lot is the question of technological inequality. The assumption among some innovators who, you know, are optimistic and well-meaning a lot of the time, is that technologies will somehow solve problems of inequality, right? That by giving new possibilities to the people who are marginalized in some way in society, we can solve problems that our political bodies have singularly failed to address over generations. And you know, there are examples of technologies that do that, where, you know, technologies that genuinely do feed starving people and cure the diseases that bedevil poor people in poor countries. But what we need to do is think about, well, what made those technologies successful as emancipatory things? And why doesn't more technology do that? So we just need to have that informed debate, rather than presuming that, you know, being optimistic and well-meaning is going to get us there.
Yeah. And I think that transitions nicely into my next like point of discussion, is for incoming undergraduates who are trying to, again, I think we've laid out kind of the critical thinking that we want to give, but essentially providing, so this, we see this issue, and I think STS again is why it makes a brilliant program. Like in other disciplines, they don't perhaps allow this scope that science, like our department, allows to really get into the nitty-gritty of these issues, which I really enjoy. Yeah, so I would say for undergraduates coming in, I mean, I think you've explained quite well that it's not, we're both agreed that it's not a case of thinking, oh, technology is all good or all bad. It's kind of, okay, what's good, what's bad, and let's have more of an intellectualized discussion about it, drawing on different disciplines, drawing on sociology, drawing on, like you said, of inclusivity and inequality in technology, but also policy, because this module is centered on policy. So I think a lot of the questions raised in this we've discussed tend to be quite more concerned about morality, but we just let's just shift a bit to the policy side of it, and the more liberal, like technology in its place of liberal democracy. We have quite an international cohort coming from different places, and I think one thing again I love enjoying being at UCL is because I get to hear so many different perspectives on how technology is seen in different countries. Because I feel like being here, we kind of just see it as like a free market thing that limited control over here. But in other countries, that's not the same. So again, what your thoughts are on that in terms of policy in particular and technology? Because we have departments, governmental departments for it, but even then they come across so many different problems. Like today I would bring up maybe the tracking system for coronavirus and how that would entail. I mean, it's not functioning at the moment, but things like that, like how easily they come into society without much democratic debate, and levels lower than just government. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The big policy problem that I would say new technology presents is it has its roots in a particular sort of in a folk philosophy of technology, which, you know, we might call technological determinism, which is the idea that technology just happens, right? And the idea that technological development is just inevitable, and therefore it is the job of governments to accelerate that, because technology equals progress and progress equals good. So that would be the sort of the caricature of the dominant approach to technology. What you see, to take your point about, you know, the international, it is really interesting. When you look at how different countries approach technologies, you see that actually there's multiple possible paths that technology can take. There's multiple approaches that governments can take to technology. If you just look at what's happening at the moment about, you know, as national governments in the US and UK discuss what to do about the presence of the Chinese company Huawei in the rollout of the 5G system, right? Those are decisions that will be hugely consequential for the next generation of our communication tools. And those are also questions of global politics. I mean, my own work at the moment, a lot of my research is on self-driving cars, where, you know, if you listen to Silicon Valley, they would tell this story that, oh, well, it's inevitable that a computer will learn to do all the things that a human can do in terms of driving, and therefore just take over from a driver. Job done. The technology is inevitable. It's just about how quickly we can make that happen. But actually, if you look at what different countries are doing in terms of the development of self-driving cars, their approaches are really different. Some of them, like in the US, are saying this is just about getting as much data, as much AI inside the car as possible. And some of them in places like China and Singapore are saying, well, no, what you need is a whole system approach to this. You need to have the car connected to other things. You need to redesign your cities so that they can be friendly environments for self-driving cars. And those decisions will take you down some very different paths. They will lead to very different shapes for our cities, very different ways of getting around. So if you're a technology policy person, those are a big deal, even though you might feel like at the moment those decisions are, you know, the content of those discussions is quite geeky. So the example that you bring up is a really important, really interesting one at the moment, which is this, you know, the possibility that we might have apps that enable us to know when we have been in contact with somebody that has had the coronavirus, and that might then enable public health authorities to do something about it. Now, there again, the dominant approach has been to say, oh, well, technology can help us solve that problem. That was the sort of starting point, and you had some British ministers, most notably Matt Hancock, the health secretary, who is enthusiastic about technology, saying, yes, technology is going to be the biggest, most important part of that. And he's had to roll back a bit from that message, as it's turned out that the British approach to that technology has been an outright failure. And one of the reasons why it's failed is quite a difficult, geeky thing to do with the details of the particular technology. The politics of that technology in terms of, you know, whether it is a centralized system run by the NHS in which all of the data flows upwards, or the alternative, which was suggested by Apple and Google's collaboration, which is a decentralized system in which no one authority knows the information that is coming from people's mobile phones, but that the data about the contacts between them can tell us useful things about the passage of the virus, right? That is a sort of, that's a really geeky question of computer science. And yet on that question turns the success or failure of the technology, and also turns the politics of that technology. And, you know, the British government have been embarrassed once already in terms of their failure to do that. And they're now facing a difficult technology policy decision, which they have to make, you know, in real time at high speed, working out who to listen to and whose voices to put particular emphasis on. And that's a huge policy challenge that at the moment policymakers aren't well equipped to deal with.
No, I understand exactly. And it is, again, it's the uncertainty of it all. And I think what's is a kind of frightening is how quickly these decisions need to be made. When they, as you can see, there's so many moral questions, so many data questions that arise from it. Yet we're in a situation where these decisions need to be made extremely quickly in a way that I personally have never seen before. And usually, again, because we have access to these technologies, and I think it's different with other types of things where with technology, it can be start up so quickly. If you throw money at it and you seem to, you know, develop, it can develop very, very quickly. So this kind of, again, because we live in this instant gratification society where if there's a problem and we have the technology for it, it's like, go, go, go. But again, it's like taking a step back and understanding, okay, where exactly is this going, etc. And you can have the privilege of doing that for things like self-driving cars, but in situations like this, I don't think that we always have that privilege to be able to make such an intellectualized and slower, more reflective debate. So yeah, I think we'll finish it up for today. This has been a really great discussion. Hopefully it's been informative to students coming in. Thank you for taking the time out to actually be a part of this podcast. I really appreciate it, Jack. And
it's been an absolute pleasure, Nazar. Thank you very much.
No problem. So I'll finish it up here. I hope you enjoy it, and yeah, see you all next time.
Well, that's our show for today. Thanks to Dr. Jack Stilgo for the interview, and thanks to Nisa Mia for her work interviewing Jack, and then her expert work post-production. You'll hear more from Nisa in later episodes. You also can hear her on the podcast she herself created. It's called The Spilled Milk Podcast, and it's on all regular podcast platforms. Music for today is Roland at 5 by Kevin MacLeod. It's available on the website filmmusic.io. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you're thinking about a degree in science and technology policy or any of the other subjects we cover, please let us know. We're always happy to talk. We'll have another episode in a few weeks. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss it. In the meantime, I'm Professor Joe Kane. Thanks for listening. Listening to We Are STS. a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe, share, and review.